Major PT, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, Major PT, when you first joined the Army?
I was on the Army Officers Emergency Reserve before the war, and I can't recall now the exact time when I put on a uniform. But I went up to Chilwell, the base, COD Chilwell, which was motor vehicle depot, and there I was officer in charge of central receipts for a time, and then the returned stores depot. And this was just about the time of the evacuation from Dunkirk. And one day I was called to the brigadier's office and told that there was a certain Colonel King wanted to be shown around. And I was appointed to do this. And I'd only been there 2 or 3 months, and there was a great deal that I didn't know. But whenever Colonel King asked me a question, I said, well, I don't know the answer, but I do know who does. I'll find him. About 2 weeks after that, I was told, Colonel King wants to see you in certain office. And I went along, thinking I'd probably blotted my copybook in some way. And he said, number one base ordnance depot in France is being reformed. The War Office has given me the job, and it's given me the privilege of choosing my own officers. Are you coming? And I said, if you want me, I'll come. And he said, go and get inspected and injected. And that's how I got overseas, because they started reforming the base ordnance depot in a camp at Strelley, just outside Nottingham. And I eventually became OC, number 4 Ordnance Store Company. And we moved to Aldershot. We were in Ramillies Barracks. And then in due course, we were told, go overseas. We embarked at Avonmouth and went up to the Clyde, where the convoy was forming. And it was on December the 6th, 1941, that we set sail from the Clyde. And the next day, when the radio news came on, was the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But we were all fitted out for North Africa, as far as one could judge by the color of our tropical kit. We got to Durban on a ship called the Highland Princess, and there we had orders to transship, and I was OC troops on RMS Andes in Durban, and then transshipped again without moving into an old ship called City of Canterbury. Well, I must say my heart began to sink when I saw cases being loaded into the hold marked Ordnance Officer Singapore, because we had heard during the voyage about the Japanese advance along the Malayan Peninsula, and we knew that they were just about in Johor. Well, the City of Canterbury plodded along, and we got to the Sunda Straits between Java and Sumatra. Incidentally, Krakatoa was a wonderful sight. And there we met a convoy which I now know had come from India. And the ship that I was on, City of Canterbury, an old Canadian Pacific liner, Empress of Asia, and a free French ship called Felix Roussel, set out from the Sunda Straits. We had Sunderland flying boats escorting us for part of the way, and an old light cruiser called HMS Danay was the escort. Well, pretty soon we were attacked. As soon as the Sunderland flying boats had reached our range, we were attacked by 27 Japanese high-level bombers that dropped sticks on us, and then came in dive bombers. And I have to backtrack a little bit here, because we had got 4 Bofors guns up from the hold. We mounted 2 in the forward well deck and 2 in the after well deck. And we got up a large number, I think about 40 Bren guns from the hold, which we had on tripods and some lashed to the rigging. We only had 3 Bren guns of our own. But this made quite a bit of armament. And when we were attacked by these Japanese dive bombers, we loosed off everything we had. I kept a count of the first 26,000 rounds of ammunition that were loosed off, and that was expended in a matter of seconds with all these guns going. And we only had 400 rounds of Bofors ammunition, and we soon expended that. But our fellows thought that they had hit three Japanese planes, or three were brought down. But it wasn't necessarily from us, because Felix Roussel and Empress of Asia were also loosing off everything that they had. And somebody hit something, but I've read in this book of No Time for Geishas, they said four were brought down, although I only thought three at the time. But we went into Singapore Harbour in Keppel Roads, and we landed that evening. It had to be done after dark and very quickly, because we were the last ships in to get out RAF personnel and nurses and civilians. And a very strange coincidence there. As we pulled into the quayside, a voice called out, "Any ordnance on board?" And it was an old friend of mine from Winchester, who was a lieutenant colonel in Singapore at that time. We went to the ordnance camp, a hutted camp sort of thing, and fixed up in the officer's mess. I had a Chinese batman called Ah Ping, and of course the next day, this would be February the 5th we landed, and I think it was February the 6th that the Japanese crossed over into the island. I'm not too sure about the dates now. But we were told then to go to a place called Bukit Timah, and of course we'd never heard any of these Malay words, but it turned out that we were to be sort of a support line. Our brigadier, MacBeatty, his name was, of the he wanted the ordnance to take their part in the final defence of Singapore. And we spent a night up on a ridge overlooking the Straits of Johor, and then got word to retire, and we marched back along the railway line right into Singapore railway station. And there I was given the job of messing officer. And we had some of these hot-lock insulated containers, and we had a truck. And at that time I had 16 catering corps cooks, and we were turning out in the hotel kitchen, you know, M&V, and sending it up the line. But then a bomb dropped beside the, very close to the truck, and tipped it over, and we lost all our containers and everything. The Singapore was being shelled, the water supply to the hotel was cut off, the gas was cut off, we'd lost all our cooking utensils. But we went round all the hotel bedrooms and collected all the old-fashioned china wash basins to use them for stew pans. We ran a fire hose in from outside through the windows to provide the water. And down in the hotel cellars, we found 16 charcoal braziers or more. At any rate, we brought up 16, and we started cooking meals in the hotel wash basins on these charcoal braziers. And I couldn't help laughing at the time to see my 16 cooks all on their hands and knees blowing at the charcoal to try and get it to generate a little more heat. Well, then we spent one very uncomfortable night just sleeping on a ground sheet on the floor. And the next day we got the word that of the capitulation, and we were told to throw our revolvers and ammunition in piles, and Japanese soldiers started appearing. And we started, or I started, to sort of prepare myself for captivity after I got over the shock, being only 10 days after landing. And I had to get what equipment we could onto a truck, and I actually rode out to Changi, being better off than other people, because it's about an 18-mile march. But as I had this messing equipment, I had it on the truck, and I rode out with it. What happened then, roughly, was that they put up a barbed wire fence around Changi, and we were just sort of internees, in a sense, because the Japanese, I suppose, were pressing on to Java and Sumatra. Well, after about 2 weeks, our own rations ran out, and the Japanese were just dumping sacks of rice, and we were doing the best we could. There was a certain amount of trading went on. The fellows were very ingenious at getting out under the wire into a Malay kampong and trading or buying something. And one thing which was really, I think, rather an achievement was that we got some additions to this very meagre rice diet, which we thought was the sweepings from the holds of ships. One of the chaps came in with some sort of grass which smelt of lemon. I believe it's citronella grass. And so about once a week we had lemon-flavoured rice. Another fellow brought in something. I think he'd been in Singapore sometime and recognised the plant, and he brought in ginger. So about once a week we could have ginger-flavoured rice. One fellow actually managed to smuggle in a can of tomatoes, and as I'm rather keen on gardening myself, we made an experiment with this. We dried out the canned tomatoes, because I know the seed germinates very easily, and we sterilized some soil on a piece of corrugated iron, which we were able to get a fire going underneath, and we used this and sowed the seed from the dried out canned tomatoes, and we got 6 tomato plants. And we were so in need of the vitamins by this time from some sort of fresh fruit that we actually had to put a guard on them, because there were 45,000 troops in Changi and anybody would have been ready to pick a ripe tomato.
How long did it take for these tomatoes to grow?
Only about 6 weeks, if I remember rightly. The climate is so lush there. If you scatter peanuts on the floor, you get peanuts in 6 weeks. I think the tomatoes took probably a bit longer than that, but after all, it is 40 years ago, and I don't remember, except that they were very precious. Well, then things began to get a bit organized in Changi, and there have been lots of people have written about their own accounts of that. But one thing that I remember in particular was that they had an arts and crafts exhibition. And I have at home now something which I really treasure. Just before the actual fall of Singapore, when we were coming back from this ridge where we were supposed to be defending the lions, I found a door off its hinges on the ground, which had been shattered, and I got 2 teak panels, about 14 inches by 10. When you're a prisoner of war and realize the end's near, you sort of tend to pick up things in case they'll be useful. And these were Malayan or Burmese teak, and I thought were nice pieces of wood. And I think that I can describe the result as a replica of the Royal Army Ordnance Corps badge mounted on a panel of teak.
You carved this with a knife?
I carved it with my pocket knife, smoothed it down with pieces of broken glass, and polished it with brown boot polish. And the back of the shield, which forms the centerpiece of an ordnance badge, I hollowed out, and I managed to conceal $120, American dollars, there throughout the whole duration of the war. The Japanese never found them. This badge, as you might call it. It was something which the Japanese seemed to respect later on. They used to ask what it was, and I explained it was our regimental badge, and the Japanese always called it the Rentai no Maku. And they seemed to think that because I had carried my regimental badge with me throughout the whole war, there must be something almost, that I must have a great respect for my regiment. But that will come in a bit later on when we go on talking, I think. Well, then the time came when the Japanese told us that they were going to send us to rest camps and we were going to a better climate and so on. And I was on what was called B Party, which went down to, we were taken down to the docks, and we went through a sort of a disinfecting ship, or delousing ship, I don't know what you would call it. We had to strip naked, and then we all in hot baths, probably they were about 10 feet square. And then while we were having these baths, the Japanese undoubtedly searched every bit of stuff which we'd brought on board. And then we went back and dressed ourselves, and we were moved again to another ship called the Fukai Maru. And there were well over 1,000 people were pushed onto this boat, and literally you could not sit down. It was like being on the beach at a bank holiday. And eventually, after much discussion, they managed to persuade the Japanese to take about 400 off, and we were told that we must stay in the holds. And the holds had been fitted up with shelves about 3 feet or 3 feet 6 inches from the ground, and each man was allowed 6 feet length by 18 inches wide for his allotted space. And eventually the old Fukai Maru pulled out, and we were eventually allowed a few at a time on deck because the heat was intolerable in these circumstances, the tropical sun, and inside a steel box, in effect. And we were at sea, and I'll try to make the voyage as short as we can, really, because nothing much happened, except that people died.
What did they die of?
Dysentery and cholera, because there were no latrines as such on the ship. There was just planks over the side, really, and two at the front end of the ship and two at the aft end. And we stopped for a time off the end of the delta of the river Mekong, somewhere off Saigon. People who had served out in Malaya before recognized it. And then we arrived at the port of Takao in Taiwan, or Formosa, and we stayed there about a week or perhaps a little bit more. Men going ashore on working parties, the officers supposedly to supervise, and the place where I went was evidently a petrol depot, probably 20 litre, I suppose, would be the size of the cans. We managed to puncture quite a number of them, so any little bit of sabotage, if you could drop one on a sharp stone and spring a leak, was very welcome. Then we went back onto the Fukai Maru, and the convoy headed onwards.
Before we go on to the further voyage from Taiwan, did you have any contact with the Taiwanese population?
No, we were very strictly separated from them, not allowed any contact whatever. The Japanese guards got into one of their shouting matches. There was no opportunity. We just landed on a jetty and were marched straight into this petrol storage dump and sort of sat about there all day long. I think the men were mostly sort of restacking the cans or I never really made out what they were supposed to be doing. Except they were just given the job of humping cans from place to place. Perhaps the Japanese were looking for leaking cans or rusted cans. But the Fukaimaru set sail again with other ships, and we arrived at Fusan. And there we were marched around the town, put on show as the captives of the greater co-prosperity sphere of East Asia. And then on a train, and we went up to Seoul.
Before going to Seoul, perhaps we should say that Fusan is in southern Korea.
Yes.
How did the population react to this public parading of the POWs in Fusan?
Well, they spat at us and jeered a bit. But Fusan, I found very interesting. It was the first time I'd been out in the Far East at all. And I was very intrigued to see the older people in Korea wearing their real native costume. The old men wore sort of miniature top hats made of braided horse hair, black horse hair. And I remember seeing a man who was obviously a white Russian in a great big fur coat and a sort of cap which is now commonly worn here, Astrakhan cap. But when we got to Seoul, which the Japanese had renamed Keijo, we were all in a big warehouse, and there were officers and men from the 18th Division there, and regulars who'd been in Singapore before the war even broke out. And we never really got to know one another very much, because it was all sort of jostling around. But again, the Japanese organized working parties. At this time, the men were taking bags of rice from a warehouse and loading them onto trucks, something to do with the Japanese commissary, as they called it. And after a short time there were just 100 British were selected, and we were taken down to the railway station, and I found that I was the senior officer of this little party, which comprised RAMC personnel, several artillery, several from the Loyals, and just two of my own men. And after a most uncomfortable night in the train, we eventually arrived at Mukden. But I have to backtrack a little bit here to say that when we got to the train, we found it was full of Americans and Australians. And we had one case of a man with diphtheria on board, an American, and the Australian doctor did something to alleviate his sufferings, whereupon I was summoned to the train commandant's place to know why I was letting a Canadian attend to an American. And I said that I didn't even know that he was a Canadian doctor. We'd only been on the train an hour or two. But we went up there, sitting all bolt upright all night, as upright as one could, and passed over the Yalu River. And we arrived at Mukden on the 11th of November, 1942.
Can you describe what Mukden camp looked like?
Well, it was an old Chinese army camp. It was just a hutted camp. And there were probably 4 inches, I suppose, posts boarded either side, and the cavity just filled with earth. It covered about 25 acres, we estimated. And the only heating was sort of a stove made of mud bricks, which turned out to fall to pieces very quickly when we started to use them. But this was not too cold then, but we were allowed one sort of coal scuttle, I think it was 26 pounds of coal or fuel a day. But the coal was very, very soft. It was like halfway between peat and coal. I think it's called lignite commercially. It burnt very slowly, but it gave out very, very little heat. The calorific value must have been tremendously low. But we found out eventually the best thing to do was to light up the fire at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, get all the bricks as hot as you possibly could, and that would heat the place reasonably well through the night. When I say reasonably well, I mean within about, you could get it to within about 5 degrees of freezing. It was bitterly cold, but the temperature in that part where you have a continental climate, we did have occasions in January when there was 70 degrees of frost. So to keep your hut at only 5 degrees of frost was really quite an achievement.
So that's 70 degrees Fahrenheit, is it?
Yes, 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
And what about your clothing?
The Japanese did issue clothing. Of course, most of us only had tropical kit anyhow, coming from Malaya. But the Japanese issued blankets, which were very threadbare. You could hold them up to the light and see fairly well through them, although they weren't actually in holes in the sense of tears. They were just like netting because they were so worn. And they also issued us with some overcoats. And mine was dated 1904, evidently saved up from the Russo-Japanese War. They also issued us with boots, which had, some of us had actually a sort of a rabbit skin lining inside. Otherwise, I think many people would have had lost their toes through frostbite. Of course, we were much too far north for rice growing, and we went over to a diet which was mostly soya beans, and what the Americans call corn mush. We should call it maize flour, I think, and they made a sort of porridge out of this.
Corn mush or mash?
Mush. We used to call it corn mush. Mash is probably the correct description, but mush describes it better in consistency. It was completely flavorless, and sometimes it would come to us only just warm. And I remember complaining to the camp commandant on one occasion that we gave this sort of corn bran mash, whatever you call it, to horses which had stomachs that digested it, but we human beings needed to have it cooked before we could digest it. Whereupon, of course, I got a tirade of abuse that we ought to be grateful for small mercies, and as we were captives, we had no rights of any sort at all. And I'm sort of explain here that there was continual bickering over being treated as prisoners of war, and the Japanese military code does not admit that there is such a thing as a prisoner of war. One must admire them for their own loyalty and determination. But because they can't allow their own, or won't allow their own troops to be made prisoners of war, they said that we were not prisoners of war either. They just don't admit the term exists. We were just captives.
How did you keep yourselves amused in this camp?
Well, I think if I may, I sort of cut back to Changi for a moment because it leads into what we did. In Changi, we had people from all sorts of walks of life. And I mentioned that we had an arts and crafts exhibition where I won the first prize for my ordnance badge. We also had a male voice choir going, and